Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There comes a point in economics and in politics, I suppose, where the numbers just stop being real. $100 billion over 10 years, a trillion over 20 years. What does that mean anyway? Accounting for the healthcare bill today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Trusted Choice Independent Insurance Agents, offering a choice of companies and coverage. You can find a local agent at 1-800-WE-INSURE.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is a Thursday today. This one is the 18th of March, and it is good, as always, to have you here. Other than the actual voting, I think Congress cleared the last big hurdle in the health care debate today. We got the official scorecard on it this morning. It's going to cost the government $940 billion over 10 years. Over 20 years, though, the bill is supposed to shave more than $1 trillion off the budget deficit. Those are big numbers to wrap your brain around, but really, at this point in a long, long debate, do they even matter? We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer to figure it out.
The numbers come from the Congressional Budget Office. It said today the final version of the Democrats' health care overhaul would cut the deficit by $138 billion over 10 years.
I don't take the number too seriously.
That's Paul Light. He's a professor of public service at New York University. He says the health care overhaul now appears inevitable.
Now, it is a done deal, more or less. I don't think anybody's going to be swayed one direction or the other. You know, ultimately, the number is going to fade from memory rather quickly.
And ultimately, the deficit reduction number might turn out to be wrong. These predictions are really hard to make. Vivian Ho is a healthcare economist at Rice University.
What's important whenever you're doing these predictions is to predict how people will respond in terms of what type of health insurance policy they're going to buy and whether they're even going to buy health insurance or not.
The polite term for this uncertainty among economists is elasticities.
And so sometimes they get the elasticities wrong.
Economist Paul Vanderwater did cost estimates for Congress for 18 years at the CBO. He says elastic as the health care numbers are, they could help sway undecided members of Congress.
There were some members that wanted to be absolutely sure that the proposal they're going to vote on will be fiscally responsible, that it won't add to the deficit, and now they have confirmation.
And if the numbers are wrong, they can blame the CBO. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
While health care has been the belle of the ball, climate change legislation has been in the congressional deep freeze for months now. But there does seem to be a bit of a thaw coming. At a meeting on Capitol Hill yesterday, key members of the Senate shared what they've been working on with some business groups. The Once and Future approach picks up where earlier legislation left off. It is supposed to limit industrial greenhouse gas emissions. And there's a new twist, too, encouraging individuals to limit their pollution as well. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
This proposal uses a market-based system. The government caps emissions and companies trade pollution permits. But it also peppers in something else. Lou Hayden of the American Petroleum Institute.
They're looking at a cap-and-trade approach for stationary sources of greenhouse gases like utilities, some kind of linked fee on fuels.
It's that linked fee that's the new part, and it would cover gasoline, diesel, airplane fuel. Consumers would pay at the pump or the gate.
And that may look something more along the lines of a carbon tax, although they won't use the term tax.
Ron Pernick runs consulting firm Clean Edge. He says the goal is to have consumers see the cost directly.
We've gotten very used to low-cost energy, and energy is going to cost more.
If you can directly attach a price to the use of carbon, people are going to be much less likely to use it in excess.
Amanda Rosen is a political scientist at Webster University. She says behavior is likely to change in the long run as more fuel-efficient cars hit the market, but
If you, you know, live in the suburbs and you need to commute into the city to work, you can't just buy a new house in the middle of the city, you know, change your children's schools and move on a dime because your gas bill got really high. In terms of the short run, the changes you could make are actually pretty limited.
Rosen says people will probably have plenty of time to get ready. The legislation hasn't even been formally proposed yet. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
RVs, that is recreational vehicles, can be a pretty good indicator of a coming recession. They are expensive. They are decidedly not a necessity. And in fact, the RV business was beat up pretty good the past couple of years. Today, though, some better news. Winnebago posted its first quarterly profits in more than a year, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Winnebago is selling more RVs, but not to consumers. Dave Whiston follows Winnebago at Morningstar, and he says most of the buyers are dealers.
So the challenge now is, now that the dealers have ordered the product, will the consumers walk into a dealer showroom and buy?
Whiston says a lot of people put off buying the vehicles when the economy was bad. Now dealers are betting demand will pick up as the economy keeps getting better.
You're seeing more people willing to go ahead and take the plunge. And you know, frankly, if you're retired, you can't wait forever to buy that RV.
And increasingly, that RV means a Winnebago. Catherine Thompson follows the company for Thompson Research. It's an equity research firm. She says, in a way, the recession actually helped Winnebago.
You've had some major competitors either go out of business and file for bankruptcy.
That means a lot less competition for Winnebago. The company's hired back some workers and upped production to meet the new demand. But it's still not expecting a smooth ride. The CEO said the economic outlook remains uncertain. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Traders kind of lollygagged their way to a split decision today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Any chance you remember the last time you bought an actual physical compact disc? Yeah, fewer and fewer among us can, especially younger music listeners. They generally like to download their tunes instead of schlepping to a record store. And CD sales are down almost 16% so far this year. That's on top of huge drops in years immediately past. But now one major label has plans to try to sell some more of them, as Marketplace's Rico Galliano reports.
Today, Universal Music Group announced a new recommended retail price for many of its CDs. $10 a piece. Universal says this is just a short-term test for now to begin in the second quarter of the year, but retailers hope 10-buck discs are here to stay.
That's a good thing.
Joe Goldmark is a partner in Amoeba Music, a chain of three music superstores in California.
Hopefully that will drive some customers into the stores. I think it's a little overdue.
Overdue because music lovers have long been able to download albums for around 10 bucks. Industry experts do expect the lower prices to boost sales, at least for a while. Mark Mulligan is with Forrester Research.
There have been numerous trials in the U.S. and in Europe from other labels as well, which has shown that reducing the price of CDs does drive spending.
In fact, Universal and other major labels recently did a trial run. They put $10 discs in the racks at mall-based music chain FYE. Sales reportedly went up 100%. Even so, Mulligan warns CDs are inevitably dying, and the only reason labels want to prolong the death is because music downloading is still a relatively small segment of the business.
Digital music has grown very strongly in percentage terms, but it's grown so strongly because it's so small.
Amoeba Music's Joe Goldmark agrees cheap new CDs won't rescue retail stores. He says Amoeba stays afloat by selling used discs, memorabilia, DVDs, and offering one physical music format that's actually growing in sales, good old-fashioned vinyl records. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
The place to be for live music this week is Austin, Texas, in the South by Southwest Festival. More bands there than you can shake a stick at. But South by Southwest has also become something of a hotbed for new social media companies. Twitter was the new thing a couple of years ago. This year, it's something called Foursquare. Caroline McCarthy is with CNET News. Caroline, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
All right, for the uninitiated, what is this thing, Foursquare?
There are a lot of very sort of lengthy terms for this genre of application. It's a mobile social networking application. It's a location-based social networking application, or it's a geolocation service. Basically, what it is it's a way for you to broadcast your location.
And just for the heck of it, because I know he's actually on Foursquare, I've punched up John Carney, our friend from Clusterstock, who's with us in the afternoons on Fridays. Yeah.
And basically it lists this whole thing of where he's been and what he does and how many times he's been out. I mean, it's just a way to literally, as you said, let people know where you are.
Pretty much. And there were other companies that were doing the same sort of thing. And oftentimes they pitched it as a way to meet new people based on where your location was. And that creeps people out. So I think that Foursquare and a couple of close rivals that it has are finally figuring out a way that they can make these geolocation apps something that the mass market will use.
Yeah, I should probably say that Carney has yet to friend me back on Foursquare, so I can't tell you exactly where he is right now, but, you know, you get the basic picture.
Well, you know, I am friends with him on Foursquare, and if I see where he's going out tonight, I can go there, and I can ask him why he hasn't approved a friend request.
that would be great. So other than letting your friends know where you are, though, it obviously has implications for people who want to sell you stuff.
Exactly. This literally gives advertisers a way to fine-tune the most precise demographic that they possibly can. So let's say I'm someone who checks into a lot of bars very late at night
like
in
John
the
Carney.
East Village.
Oh, no, sorry, I'm just kidding.
Like John Carney.
Yeah.
Then let's say that I check into something on a particular street corner. Foursquare can sort of compute, even without knowing any of my personal details, that I am a bit of a night owl and that I may be looking for a slice of pizza at this hour. So if the local pizzeria across the street is a Foursquare advertiser, it can say, hey, you know, I think you need a bite to eat.
And that gets back to the whole creepy thing.
The thing that makes it less creepy is that it's possible for none of that personal information to actually come across.
Mm.
And additionally, what Foursquare has done is if you want to get alerts from a particular advertiser, you have had to specifically say, I want to get alerts from this. And that works for big media brands.
Foursquare is small so far, way smaller than something like Twitter or Facebook.
It is very, very small.
But is that where we're going here? I mean, is that the potential?
I'm not quite sure. I think that Facebook has phenomenal mass market appeal. Twitter has less mass market appeal. Foursquare, I think, has an even smaller user base because it's people who are primarily going out a lot, who want to know what other people are out, who want to discover new places. I think it works phenomenally well in cities. I don't necessarily think that they will have that kind of traction in small towns or in rural areas. There's not sort of that social impulse to go out and that kind of thing.
Caroline McCarthy, CNET News. Caroline, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Hey, you're on Foursquare, right?
Yeah, I am.
All right, I'm going to look you up and you better friend me, okay? Or whatever it's called.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
See you later. Basketball's annual testament to the unchecked growth of college sports started today. Out of respect for those who've TiVo'd today's early rounds of the NCAA basketball tournament, we will skip the results update, but there will be six rounds worth of games, countless office pools, millions of dollars bet elsewhere, and perhaps billions in television rights when the contract comes up for negotiation. For all of that, though, commentator John Wertheim says that March Madness also lays bare one of the great hypocrisies in college sports.
The debate over whether to pay college athletes is, of course, an old one. However, this year there's a new wrinkle. It began when former UCLA hoop star Ed O'Bannon sat down to play the video game NCAA basketball. He noticed a player in the game that looked a lot like him and bore his name, and he thought, how come I'm not getting paid for that? A few phone calls later, O'Bannon became the lead plaintiff in a class action suit on behalf of former Division I football and basketball players. They alleged the NCAA violated their rights when it used the athletes' images in perpetuity. The NCAA making money off athletes when they're in college is questionable at best. Making money off these athletes for time in memoriam, well, that's another matter altogether. The NCAA asked that the case be dismissed, but last month a judge rejected the request. So the case will proceed, and O'Bannon and others will have their day in court. Oh, and their lawyers, through the discovery process, will have the rare opportunity to comb through the NCAA's books. In similar cases, the NCAA has stated that athletes signed over their rights in exchange for the scholarships. O'Bannon doesn't deny that he signed a student-athlete agreement, but he says he was just a kid and had to do it to get a scholarship. He also points out that no parents were there, much less a lawyer, to explain the long-term implications. The NCAA has also made the case that paying athletes would sully the ideals of amateurism that college sports represent. But the, quote, amateur argument loses its force when the organization then turns around and licenses video games. That's precisely the kind of profitable marketing deal that a pro league makes. And by definition, pros get paid. The prospect of compensating college athletes is thorny. Under Title IX, it might mean that a comparable number of female athletes may need to get paid. It could burden already taxed athletic departments across the country and further corrupt an already vulnerable system. But still, it beats the status quo. The NCAA needs to figure out how to pay these athletes now. Their contention that a scholarship and some textbooks is an even trade for billions in revenue, it's not just unconscionable, it's madness.
John Wertheim is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. Send us your thoughts about basketball, football, anything else you like, really. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Straight ahead, the political ads, they are a-coming, just not where you think.
People think Google is a search engine. That's just one part of it. It's the new TV. It's not a niche media market anymore. It is mass media.
But first, let's do the numbers. It was overall a fairly uninspiring day on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials tacked on 45 points, not quite a half percent, ended at 10,779. The NASDAQ added just 2 points, a fraction of 1%, finished at 2,391. The S&P 500 ended the day more or less flat, down just a hair, closed at 1,165. Investors cozied up to their video game consoles after retailer GameStop reported better than expected earnings. Shares scored by more than 6.5%. Video game publishers also got their game on. THQ picked up more than 4%. Today, Electronic Arts tacked on 2%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.68%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at HBR.org. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to updates on the economy and business, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. President Obama speaks on health reform in Fairfax, Virginia tomorrow morning. The U.S. Standard Time Act was passed on March 19, 1918, establishing time zones and daylight savings time. And for those who love rock and roll and movie popcorn, The Runaways opens in U.S. theaters. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Obama took to the Rose Garden this morning. He signed that jobs bill that Congress passed earlier this week. $18 billion in tax breaks for companies that hire people who've been out of work for at least 6 months. But what if you never had to worry about losing your job in a down economy? That is the stuff of fairy tales for most. But for workers at Lincoln Electric in Cleveland, Ohio, it's reality. Frank Koller's book about the company and its guaranteed employment program is called Spark. Frank, welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
It's important, I suppose, to point out what this program at Lincoln Electric is not.
It's definitely not a job for life. This is a bargain between a company and its workers. The deal is very clear-cut that as long as you meet the performance standards of the company, that you will never be laid off for economic reasons. Now, that may mean your job may change, that mean your pay goes up and down, but the bottom line for the workers is that mortgages get paid, health insurance get paid, and your family does okay over the long term.
Give us a slice of life. You profile pretty extensively this woman who assembles nozzles. She was the employee of the year a couple of years ago.
Yeah, Melissa Latessa. She's a piece worker, which means that every piece that she makes, she earns a fixed rate for. And that's her job. And in good years, she does extremely well. And, you know, in tough years, I mean, last year, her bonus wasn't as big. Her base wages weren't as big. But it really is about a shared bargain, about sharing the gain, but also explicitly sharing the pain in the hard time.
You mentioned a bonus. This company has paid a bonus basically every year, and it's a substantial portion of their base wages, and it works in good times and bad times, and it really adds to the compensation package.
Absolutely. The bonus started in the depths of the Depression. That bonus has been paid every year since without exception. It's averaged about 70% of an employee's base wages. Now, last year was a tough year. It was only 38% of your base wages, but that meant that the average bonus check was $17,000.
I was struck to read, and maybe I should have known this, I don't know, that Lincoln Electric is a publicly traded company. And so Wall Street analysts and people who keep an eye on companies that trade on the stock markets, they obviously are aware of this guaranteed employment program.
No, that's what's so fascinating.
Huh.
Many of the investment analysts, and these are the folks that recommend Lincoln to institutional investors and mutual fund holders as a good stock that performs over the long term, had no idea that Lincoln Electric had anything resembling a guaranteed employment program. Now, it's not like as if it's hidden. It's in the annual report that goes to the SEC. You know, and several of them were actually quite dismissive of the idea. Their view was that guaranteeing any kind of certainty to anyone other than a shareholder was, in fact, a zero-sum game. That's simply not Lincoln's view. Lincoln's view is that everyone shares long-term.
Obviously, one of the reasons you wrote this book was because the guaranteed employment program struck your fancy. But isn't it just kind of an oddity? I mean, how relevant is it in a 21st century economy?
I've been in a lot of boardrooms and a lot of announcements where CEOs with almost crocodile tears are saying, you know, our employees are our most valuable asset, even as they are letting people go. And then they say that famous line, you know, we have no option. Well, Lincoln seems to suggest that there are options. But I think it does stand out as a symbol that there must be ways to organize your company to succeed in the marketplace long term so that you're not putting all the risk on the backs of your workers.
Frank Koller was for many years a correspondent for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. He's got a book out about a company in Cleveland, Ohio called Lincoln Electric. The book is called Spark. Frank, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
The good people at Gallup released their latest political poll results this week. The president basically breaks even. He's right around a 50% approval rating. Congress does somewhat worse. Only 16% of Americans say they approve of how lawmakers are doing their jobs. So with an election coming up this fall, it is no wonder that one estimate from the Center for Responsive Politics says politicians are going to spend almost $4 billion either holding on to their jobs or getting elected for the first time this fall. There is, of course, a whole industry dedicated to getting a slice of that pie. And as Brent Neely reports now from Washington, there's a new kid on the block, a very big new kid.
During the recent special Senate election in Massachusetts, ads like these flooded the airwaves.
My name is Scott Brown, and I'm running for the United States Senate. This is my truck.
Aside from pitching his truck, Republican Scott Brown also pitched voters with an aggressive online campaign. When voters Googled Martha Coakley, Brown's opponent, they saw plugs for Brown in the list of sponsored links on the right. Rob Willington is Brown's online strategist. He says with Google's help, the campaign was able to precisely target key markets.
So if you lived within a 30 to 45 mile radius of one of our offices, you were going to see ads saying volunteer this weekend for Scott Brown all over the place in the top 200 websites in Massachusetts.
Welcome to the world of Google-powered elections. The company calls that tactic a network blast. In Massachusetts, Willington says those blasts cost about $25,000 a day, far less than TV and worth every penny.
People think Google is a search engine. That's just one part of it. It's the new TV. It's not a niche media market anymore. It is mass media.
Most political campaigns spend at most 3-4% of their budget on online ads. The Brown campaign spent almost 10%, about $250,000. It's the biggest success so far in Google's campaign to rule the online political advertising business. In 2007, the company started a small team to help politicians tweak their messages online.
We can provide advice on which websites within our network to target, how to create your video.
Peter Greenberger runs Google's political advertising unit. Even though most campaigns still spend relatively little on online ads, Greenberger says Google's political ad business is profitable, and it's got a bright future.
There are over 500,000 elected officials in the United States. We think that every single elected official could benefit from using Google AdWords to communicate with their voters.
Meredith McGeehee of the Campaign Legal Center says the economy also has something to do with why Google has gotten into the business.
Google wants to play a role because politics, to some degree, is recession-proof.
She says the Supreme Court's recent decision to lift restrictions on corporate political spending will probably also help Google. But she's also worried about abuse.
The online advertising is generally kind of a Wild West. It's not clear exactly that you have the same kind of rules in terms of disclosure.
TV and radio stations have to keep a public file of political ad clients. Google doesn't. And Google says that they don't track their clients because the ad services they provide are largely do-it-yourself. Already, a new generation of campaign consultants are spreading Google's gospel to candidates. Josh Koster is a partner with the liberal political consulting firm Chong & Koster.
Google was the very first place we ever bought an ad and the place we spend most of our budget to this day.
Koster's firm has piloted several new Google advertising products. Some, such as geographical targeting, have been picked up by movie studios and car companies and later used in targeted corporate marketing efforts. Koster says that's the real reason Google has gotten into politics.
And ultimately, I think that what they learn in politics and the case studies they get in politics, they can turn around and help sell any industry.
He says if a campaign can win an election with smart, cheap advertising using Google, imagine what a small business can do. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. By Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture and creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. More at producemoreconservemore.com. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note this afternoon in which Alan Greenspan says, hey, that whole housing crash, financial crisis thing, not my fault. Greenspan has done what economists do when they want to prove a point. He has written a research paper. He'll present it at the Brookings Institution tomorrow, 48 pages long. That's text, and then there's appendices, charts, and graphs, and all that. But you can skip right to the relevant passage on page 37, the part where he says the low interest rates that he set while he was running the Federal Reserve had absolutely nothing to do with it. Check it out yourself. We've got a link online, marketplace.org. It's really not that tough a read. I recommend it. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 45 points, almost a half percent. The NASDAQ ticked up 2 points, just a fraction of 1%. The S&P 500 ended more or less flat, lost about a third of 1 point. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this broadcast, undocumented children secretly seeking the American dream.
We are a shadow society, I guess. Always hiding, always fearful of being deported.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.